I'm Rudy Podgornik from NIH also, and I'm leave from the University of Ljubljana in Slovenia. My background is in colloid physics and biophysics. I did a lot of work on DNA-DNA interactions and membrane-membrane interactions, specifically fluctuational interactions of all sorts, steric fluctuations, electrostatic fluctuations, van der Waals interactions, and lately, I'm very much involved in the van der Waals interactions between carbon nanotubes, which is also what I will, you know, discuss very briefly at this informal seminar, and in particular, and also fluctuational forces in Coulomb fluids, classical Coulomb fluids, in strong and weak coupling regimes, and well, that's pretty much it. Okay, so Mehran said this is going to be an informal seminar, and I took it verbatim, of course. This is an informal seminar. No transparencies prepared. I will talk a little bit about our recent interest in the interactions between carbon nanotubes. I suppose you all know what carbon nanotubes are. And if not, imagine you have a two-dimensional graphene sheet, which is a two-dimensional layer of carbon atoms with strong interatomic bonds, of course, and then you roll it up and create something that looks like a tube. And you can roll it up in different ways because the lattice of the graphene sheet is locally hexagonal, and you can roll it up like that, or, you know, with a twist, you can roll it up like that. And depending on how you roll it, the dielectric response of a tube like that can vary a lot. You can go from, you know, from a metallic response to non-metallic response, depending on how you roll the graphene sheet up. And carbon nanotubes are very hydrophobic. I should tell you that because, of course, carbon, like in diamond, it's a very hydrophobic surface. So even if you take a graphene sheet, make a carbon nanotube out of it, it is very hydrophobic, and it does not want to dissolve in aqueous solution. So it makes this condensed blob. It looks black. And that's carbon nanotubes that are held together by hydrophobic interactions in water. The first problem here is, how are we going to dissolve these carbon nanotubes in an aqueous solution? Can we do that? Is that possible? And the other problem is, since the way you produce carbon nanotubes, you get all sorts of sizes. And of course, in physics, you want to have a well-defined size distribution of the objects that you make. And the question is, can you separate them somehow? You start with a mess of carbon nanotubes with different lengths, and then can you separate them in fractions according to the length? So you would get a mono-disperse sample of carbon nanotubes. And in order to do that, of course, you have to know what the interactions are between carbon nanotubes. I will not talk about the short-range interactions, which are hydrophobic. That's a question of, you know, statistical mechanics of water and what does water do close to hydrophobic surfaces. A very murky subject, lots of different approaches, but no real definitive theory of what's going on in hydrophobic interactions. I will tell you about long-range interactions, which are of van der Waals type. In fact, they are van der Waals interactions, and it fits right into the general scheme, I guess, of this workshop. And I will discuss or tell you a little bit about the work that we did recently and what I would like to do here. So how do you calculate van der Waals interactions between cylinders? You can do it in many different ways. And yesterday, we heard from Torsten about the general method, how to approach that problem by scattering matrices and so on. But I will pursue here a different approach. First of all, in van der Waals interactions, you should understand that there are many different ways to do that. You can approach them from this direction, from that, from here, from there. They all lead to the same result eventually, if you do it properly, of course. But there are many different point of views to approach van der Waals interactions. If we go to the original Lifshitz theory, or if we go to Landau-Lifshitz volume and look at how they do interactions between small objects, the way they do it is they take two semi-infinite slabs of a certain material, let's call it M. No, M is going to be the medium in between, and this we call left medium and right medium. And you can derive from the Lifshitz theory the interaction free energy. So this is all at finite temperature. I mean, you can do zero temperature also, but usually in van der Waals interactions in condensed media, we are also interested in the temperature effect. So this is a finite temperature calculation as a function of the separation between the two. It's a standard calculation, you know. It's been done first by Lifshitz, by many other people, and so on. And you get the free energy as a function of L and as a function of all the dielectric response function of the medium in between, of the medium to the left, of the medium to the right, evaluated, of course, at the boson frequencies. And then you do the summation over the boson frequencies, and you get the free energy. And how do you get from here to the interaction between two particles? This is the so-called Pitayevsky ansatz, where you say that let's make this medium rarefied, and this one also. So we go to zero with the density of these two media. And if you expand this free energy, let's call this density NL and R. If you expand the free energy to the lowest order in the densities of the two media, and the way you do it is, of course, you say epsilon L and epsilon R are to the first order, they're just epsilon of the medium in between, plus a contribution that's linear in the density of the particle. And this is just the corresponding polarizability, or something like that. And if you expand this to the lowest order, it turns out that the lowest order is actually proportional to the product of the two densities in the two media, to the lowest order. Because, I mean, the lowest order, of course, epsilon is the same everywhere, and you have no interactions, obviously. So lowest order is zero. The first non-zero order is proportional to the product of densities. And it turns out, and I will not derive it. It's relatively simple to derive, but I will not do it here, that if you take the following limit, and let's say it's the same density, so I would just put it as n. So n goes to zero, and you take the second derivative of f with respect to L, that turns out to be identically equal to n squared times g of L, where g is now the interaction between two small particles with these polarizabilities. So that's the Pitayevsky ansatz. This is all old hat, of course. There's nothing new here. So one way of getting interactions between small bodies with a dielectric response as codified by their polarizabilities is to look at two semi-infinite spaces interacting across a medium M, then expanding the interaction free energy to the second order in the density of the two semi-infinite media, and the lowest order contribution is proportional to the interaction free energy between two particles with this polarizability.
Why is it then the L that is the smallest distance? Wouldn't you say that the particles are at all separations in the media?
If you go to zero with the density, right, the first one that you're going to hit is, by construction, will be at the separation R, L, I guess.
Well, you're taking a second derivative, you're taking little slices.
Yeah, second derivative means, yeah, you just take a little slice here, a little slice there, and that's the interaction. Yeah, this is why you have second derivative.
I have a simple question. I mean, you're saying F is the free energy. But I mean, I understand that the force will be proportional to ML times NR, but so this is a difference of free energy?
This is the interaction free energy. Yeah.
That's clear, but that
okay.
The F.
On F. The F is the interaction free energy between two semi-infinite.
So you subtract
yeah.
The
absolutely. Okay. Yes. Yes. So it's regularized so that it goes to zero as L goes to infinity. So that's the Pitayevsky ansatz. And now the question is this. I mean, if you look at the Landau-Lifschitz volume, this is done for spherical, let's say. For two media composed of spherical particles, and you get the standard expression for the van der Waals interaction free energy between two small particles. That is a quadratic functional of, or actually quadratic function of the corresponding polarizability.
And you get also the both, the retard and the non-retard?
Absolutely, yeah. If, of course, the free energy that you have here is non-retarded, then you get only the non-retarded. If it's retarded, then you get the whole shebang. Yeah? And it's, you know, you can derive it, as I said, in many different ways. There are other approaches, and they're completely consistent. What you end up with at the end, the G as a function of L or of R, the separation between the particle, is the same in all these cases.
Basically make use of the fact that if the medium is so diluted, then that you can basically use additivity, and therefore
that's what it is. Yeah, yeah. And additivity, of course, is exact as you go to zero with the density. So that's the approach here. As I said, this is the standard approach to devised by Pitayevsky and colleagues, and we use the same philosophy to get the interactions between cylindrical objects now. And cylindrical objects, if you look at the carbon nanotube, so here's a nanotube, of course, it's got a different response in the parallel direction than in the perpendicular direction. So this is a work that we did together with a few other people, and I should mention Rick Ryder from MIT, then Roger French from DuPont Chemicals, and Wei-Yin Ching from University of Missouri, Kansas City. And they are the guys who actually did the computation of a dielectric response of a carbon nanotube from first principles. This is all quantum mechanics. And by doing this and that, they get epsilon of omega. They get epsilon parallel of omega and epsilon perpendicular of omega. And let me just remind you that what you have in the Lifschitz formula is epsilon of I omega at imaginary frequencies. You have to sum the expression over the boson frequencies on the imaginary axis. So what comes into the formula is this, the two terms, so epsilon parallel and epsilon perpendicular of the carbon nanotubes evaluated at imaginary boson frequencies.
So presumably depends on length, diameter.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Helicity, everything. It depends a lot, actually, on that. It's crucial to know what kind of, you know, how's your folding done when you get to the carbon nanotube. That depends, that determines the dielectric response. So these people have calculated all sorts of, you know, foldings from one to the, I mean, I can't, there's just too much data.
That you have. How are these epsilons calculated?
How are they can? Well, unfortunately, I can't tell you much about the details how they do that, because what I do is the Lifschitz part. They give me the epsilon of omega, and then I go through this and that and get the interaction free energy.
But you believe the
epsilon? Yeah. So these are, you know, for some materials, you can compare the calculations with experiments, and it works pretty well. Unfortunately, these are, of course, different type of materials. Let's say strontium titanate. For strontium titanate, which is a crystal, you can do electron spectroscopy, let's say valence electron spectroscopy, to get the epsilon of omega in the optical regime. And you can calculate it, and you see it's very close. The calculation is very close to the experiment. For carbon nanotubes, I don't think anybody has actually measured that yet, but maybe they will.
There's a group at NIST that has a pretty good carbon spectrum.
Yeah.
To calculate the measured numbers. But the trouble is, that you never know if you have a pure cardinality population when you do the spectrum.
So that, I guess my worry is how are the geometric factors gotten correctly? I mean, as you say, experimentally you have a mixture, there's only obviously.
Yeah, it's going to be a tough problem. Yeah. For now, there's no data. For now, there's no data. But let's assume you get epsilon of omega from somewhere. Then from that, you can construct the interaction free energy. However, and this is the crucial difference here. This is anisotropic. And of course, we have now two anisotropic media. The calculation I described before is for isotropic media, where the two small particles are isotropic. Now, for carbon nanotubes, they are essentially anisotropic. And you have to generalize the whole approach to non-isotropic media. And first of all, you have to get the interaction-free energy for two non-isotropic media as a function of the separation, as well as the relative angle of orientation. So here you have a uniaxial medium, of course, the carbon nanotubes. You assume they are in a, let's say, hexagonal array. And the long axis is pointing in a certain direction. And it's a different direction in this medium than in this medium. And it turns out, after you do the Lifshitz calculation, that the free energy depends on the difference relative difference between the two orientations. Now, in the non-retarded case, it's a relatively simple calculation. It's been first done, I think, by Adrian and George Weiss in the 70s, I guess, right? Whatever. And what you see is that the free energy depends on this relative orientation, which means that apart from the van der Waals interactions, you also have a van der Waals torque. That's the main and the most important difference. So the free energy depends on the relative orientation. And if you change that orientation, of course, you will see a van der Waals torque.
Also, there is now an additional length scale in the problem, which is the length of the nanotubes.
The length of the I will say a little bit about that later on. Yes?
And your tail is now longer than the length of the nanotubes?
My what?
The separation L.
It's a lot longer, yeah. So there are two limits now. Already you have to bifurcate. One limit is where the separation between the nanotubes is a lot bigger than their size. The other one is, of course, when they're comparable. And they are two completely different calculations, unfortunately.
I think you're talking about length, not width.
Length.
Yes.
Yeah, right. Width comes in through the, yeah. So the other problem is, how do you calculate the interaction-free energy for the retarded case? It's very complicated. Just solving the Maxwell equations for three media and isotropic media, it's quite complicated. And it's been done by Barash recently. Yuri Barash, maybe you remember. Is he going to be here, by the way? No? So he's a co-author of a book on van der Waals interactions together with Ginsburg. I think this is the last one of the last problems Ginsburg worked on. And he figured out, maybe you're familiar with the Van Kampen approach, the heuristic theory of van der Waals interactions, the modes and so on. And he proved definitively that a little detail in the derivation, which was not really polished, actually works. So you can use the heuristic theory to get the correct form for the van der Waals interaction free energy. I mean, that's just small thing. Anyhow, the same character, Yuri Barash, calculated the interaction-free energy between two or three non-isotropic media in the retarded case. It's a horrible calculation. It's very, very complicated. The result, I mean, it goes on through pages. Oh, it's right here. It just looks horrible. I can't even write it down. Just complicated. So here it is. These are the final formulas. Mess. And it's very difficult to generalize it. Why? So it turns out that in the retarded case, if you have a plane parallel symmetry, so if you have lots of slabs with different dielectric response, you can reduce the calculation of van der Waals interactions to the algebra of 2 by 2 matrices. you can do that, can be done. But for the retarded case, they are 4x4 matrices. They reduce, of course, to 2x2 if you do it properly in the non-retarded limit. But the correct retarded limit can be only done with 4x4 matrices. And inverting those and looking at the eigenvalues and so on produces these long formulas.
Is it 4x4 since you have basically two polarizations?
Exactly, yes. And two fields. Yeah. I mean, you reduce the Maxwell equations to a set of... you just have to believe me. It's 4x4 matrix in the retarded case and 2x2 in non-retarded case. So obviously see that the retarded case is going to be much more complicated than the retarded case. But it can be done. You can do it, and you can do the same trick, the Pitayevsky ansatz, on the final result. And the expression that you get is not that complicated, fortunately. So you can do it in the retarded limit, in the non-retarded limit. In both cases, you should take into account that the two semi-infinite spaces are non-isotropic and contain an assembly of carbon nanotubes. And then you go to zero with the density of the carbon nanotubes. You have to figure out what the corresponding dielectric response of the composite is, and then you get the interactions. So the interactions, now I come to the length dependence. The interactions turn out to be, I mean, the original Pitayevsky formula can be applied only to the case of isotropic particles. Yeah. You can do this with isotropic particles. If they're not isotropic, the Pitayevsky formula is a little bit more complicated. Let me just write it down. It's limit, density goes to zero. It's the second derivative, again. But now it depends whether you have two cylindrical objects, two cylinders, at a finite angle, so they're skewed, or they're parallel. These are two separate limits that you can do. If they're skewed, then the interaction free energy is obtained like this. So the second derivative, as n goes to zero, the lowest order term, of course, which is quadratic, this one should go as n squared, is proportional to the sine times the interaction free energy at a finite angle. You can derive that. And if they are parallel, then you get the following result, that this is n squared . So I think this is called the Abel transform. And the G here is the free energy per unit length. And this result, of course, will be valid as long as the angle is smaller than the ratio between the width of the carbon nanotube and the length of the carbon nanotube. So once it's smaller than this, you have to go to this result. So this is interaction free energy between two carbon nanotubes, and this is interaction free energy per length of the carbon nanotube, because it scales linearly with the length. You see that you have to do some additional calculation here. You have to invert this expression to get G. And that's done by inverse Abel transform. It's relatively straightforward to do, but you need to do it to get the interaction free energy per unit length. So there you go. This is the essence of the approach. You start with two semi-infinite media, which are non-isotropic. They are composed of carbon nanotubes that have two types of dielectric response, one in the direction of the long axis, the other one perpendicular to it. Then you have to go through the modified Pitayevsky ansatz, and finally you remain with the interaction free energy, either between two skewed cylinders or two parallel cylinders. And you can go smoothly from one to the other.
How does the radius of the cylinder enter, and how does it compare to the length?
The radius enters through the epsilon of a composite is a function of the volume fraction of the cylinders. And the volume fraction, of course, is density times the area, because you have a hexagonal array that you can cut with a plane perpendicular to the long axis, and you get, of course, the radial dependence here. So if you put this into here, you will see that in both cases, the proportionality is to the second power of the cross-section, cross-sectional area. Yeah. So A dependence, the radius dependence, is definitely in there. Now, of course, I can show you how this interaction looks. Oh, okay, let me just say this. So as Mehran pointed out, this is the limit of the separation between the cylinders is much bigger than the length. Then let's go to the other limit. That one is relatively simpler. You have two carbon nanotubes at very short separation, and now the separation is, of course, a lot smaller than the length. And what you can do is the standard Ryagin approach. So you look at two surfaces that are curved close to one another, and then you just have to sum up, you do a partial summation of the integration, assuming that you have a curved surface. This is a standard approximation that you use in colloid science to figure out what is the interaction between objects that are non-planar at short separation.
But the Ryagin answer. You have three lengths, right? Don't you not just the distance and the radius, but also the length of the cylinder. So in the Ryagin approximation, then you would compare the distance between the surfaces to the radius of curvature.
Right.
So you could also have the situation where the cylinders are very long, but the distance is still large compared to the radius. So you have to compare basically two-dimensional quantities.
Could be, yeah. Could be. We didn't do that limit. Okay. We just did the Ryagin limit and the far limit. That's the two cases. So we figured out the non-retarded case relatively easily because this animal here is not that complicated, but the retarded case is a lot more complicated. Unfortunately, as I said, you know, getting the retarded interaction-free energy for two non-isotropic bodies is just messy. It's messy and just complicated. But this one can be done, and what we get is the angle and the corresponding separation dependence of the interaction, and it depends, of course, what you put in for the dielectric response. And this is where we got, where we used the, let me just write down what is the final form for the interaction schematically. So this is, okay, we also looked at the interactions between carbon nanotubes and planar substrates. That's also important in colloidal applications. So you have a carbon nanotube somewhere in space, and it's close to a semi-infinite medium, which has a planar interface. And you want to know what is the interaction as a function of the separation, as well as the spatial orientation of the carbon nanotube. And that you can do also. In that case, of course, the Pitayevsky formulae are a little bit different. First of all, here you get only first derivative, and here you get a linear contribution linear in the density. That's due to the fact that one interface you keep fixed, and the other one you do the Pitayevsky limit. That's why it's linear in N, and you get a first derivative here. So the derivation is different, but, you know, it can be done along the same lines.
You said that these forces haven't been measured experimentally.
No, we are trying to get people to measure them directly, yeah.
What is the challenge for experiment? The getting your sample of nanotubes?
I think it's grabbing the nanotubes. I think that's the biggest problem. So we talked with different people, and they say, in principle, it could be done with optical tweezers, in principle. But nobody has actually done it yet. But they are aiming, you know, people like David Greer at NYU, they're trying to do the experiment by grabbing two nanotubes with optical tweezers and then bringing them together and measure the interaction. And of course, you can, these days, I mean, with optical tweezers, you can do all sorts of wizardry, and you can just grab a carbon nanotube at a certain orientation, and then the other one bring closer at some other orientation. That's, in principle, it's possible. But it's not been done yet.
What's the predicted strength of this material?
Yes. So, okay, this is near limit, cylinder. So the interactions go as So you can write them as this G L theta goes as 1 over sine theta. And then there are two terms. It looks like this. And this is, of course, what you're asking. What is the strength? These are like the Hamaker coefficients. Yeah. So for planar bodies, you, as you all know, you can quantify van der Waals interactions with Hamaker coefficients, and you have something similar here. Then, of course, they are different, but they are, I mean, the philosophy is the same. So let's see. The Hamaker coefficients are, we should have that somewhere in the paper. Now, it depends, of course, what kind of carbon nanotubes you take. What is their dielectric response? But they are on the order of Hamaker coefficient. Around 130 zeptojoules. So zeptojoule is a unit that these people like for some reason. And KT, they don't know what...
A sociological survey.
Yeah, it is. But
how
this
many people heard of zeptojoules?
Wow. A zeptojoule...
Perfection, okay.
I think is 10 to the minus 21 joules. So that's the order of magnitude.
So 4 zeptojoules is KT. That's right. Yeah. 4 zeptojoules is for us sitting here, yeah. KT.
Usually, let's say in soft matter, you would quantify Hamaker coefficients with KT. Yeah. Let's say membrane is 20 KT. That's typical, 10 KT. Yeah. But here in this community, it's not KT means nothing to them. You have to quantify it in zeptojoules.
So can you compare it with other forces that you can have a feeling? Is this important?
It is definitely important. You could compare it with graphite-graphite interactions, of course. And I can't give you a quantitative answer because I...
In the mnemonic, if you divide the radius by the closest separation and multiply by KT, it gives you a rough idea. So when they're really close and they're skewed, you'll get thermally significant.
Let me point out one problem of this derivation. Now, this derivation, the whole Pitayevsky ansatz, depends on the derivability or on the expandability of the free energy with respect to n. Yeah? So n goes to 0. If n goes to 0, this assumes you can do this expansion. Now, if carbon nanotubes, and there are indications that that is true, in some cases are ideal, have ideal metallic response, so you would have a 1 over omega divergence at the zero frequency. In that case, one of the dielectric functions, this one, will go to infinity. And in that case, you cannot do the Pitayevsky expansion. For that term, which is the omega zero term, this is the first order term in the summation over the boson frequencies, you cannot do the Pitayevsky ansatz. You can do it for any other frequencies because it's finite, but for omega zero, you cannot do it. So you have to figure out what the interaction, what that contribution to the interaction is by some other calculation. The Pitayevsky ansatz you cannot use in that case. But everything else works. If they're non-metallic, of course, this is a totally, totally kosher. You can do it anytime.
For the parallel orientation,
yeah,
you can consider this, for example, the separation L, mm-hmm. or this same L. Does it matter?
Should matter. Sure. Yeah.
This angle theta that you have is only this angle at the moment, right?
Yeah.
So there's no distinction in your expression for parallel cubes in this situation and this situation at the moment.
Because at very large separation, yeah.
The first one you're assuming effectively infinite, and you're looking for unit length or per interaction. where the length is large compared to the separation. This obviously immediately has finite length in it, so it's different units.
Surely, but in my opinion, just including this angle is not enough.
Yeah. That's not your opinion, that's correct.
I wonder when your angle comes in, because even if L is five times the length of the tube, then this situation can be drastically different from this one,
mm-hmm.
right? Because the electromagnetic sort of propagating fields.
Yeah.
They are dealing with epsilon parallel in this situation. They're more dealing with epsilon perp in this situation. And in extreme cases, one of the two is metallic.
Yes. Right.
It makes a hell of a difference whether you have this or this
yes.
kind of thing. So I wonder where the other angle is, the angle between this direction and the direction of the R vector that connects the centers of mass, the two cubes. So that angle psi is somewhere in the calculations, I think, but it's not yet on the blackboard. Right?
So what I didn't write down is that you have to do a final integration over all I'm not sure I can answer that.
The kinds of questions that you're asking, which are absolutely most important, we're not able to answer well enough with a rigorous derivation. If one did pairwise summations to get an intuition how these things are acting, it would tell you how the angle dependence comes into the interaction, and then it's quite intuitive. If you have this case, clearly the closest parts are dominating, and then you're getting in that direction energy that depends mainly on the closest parts with some direction. If you're talking about the skew interactions, you'll see the length showing up in the most intuitive way. That if the ends are far enough away from where the closest thing is, then basically the ends are making a small correction. If they're the way you're holding your chopsticks, then you really see that you're looking at nearest places dominating, but you're unhappy because you're doing it in this pairwise. Those are inherently difficult.
It might depend on the way you model the slabs, because you can think
could be,
about
yeah.
what these guys are doing. They're taking each layer and putting
right.
an infinite rods in each
right.
of them.
Absolutely.
But you can think of partitioning it differently by putting semi-infinite rods, which are perpendicular to the interface.
Okay.
So that would mean taking the anisotropy in a different way in the
right. Now that,
in the slats.
That's
that would
within
give
the recipe.
This
it would
situation.
Give certain right. cases, but then you have a little bit of an addition problem if you want to find out lengths in that case.
The kind of
I agree with you, of course, that's the way to do it. But give you some geometry prospect.
I'm almost sure I would be able to derive that. You see, there's a problem with this factor here immediately. If it's zero, yeah, you have to do something else. So either it's zero in this case or in this case.
It's canceled by that one.
By what?
No,
it's not canceled. No, it's a divergence. So you cannot, I mean, formally, you cannot do this limit.
Actually,
what is canceled?
The sine theta, the 1 over sine theta.
Where?
G and G of L theta is 1 over sine theta times
something. No, that's the explicit form. This is just implicit. So from this, I derive this. It's not canceled.
Just G has 1 over sine theta.
Yes, exactly. It diverges if theta goes to 0. That's why, you know, I cannot even use this formula.
Planar interaction does not diverge. The F of which he's taking the derivative does not diverge. If you're looking pairwise and then you have to normalize, then obviously the sine theta comes out as a counting factor. That's
did I understand? Israel suggested that the model for each material is infinitely long rod?
Infinitely long rod, yes.
Then
that's why I asked you when you meant length versus fat. Yeah.
But then how do you know the epsilon for each material if they are? I'm not sure that there is proper order of dilute.
There, I mean, if you look at the, let's say, hexagonally packed rods,
yeah.
you can definitely derive the composite epsilon.
Yeah.
That's the Rayleigh calculation. Where it depends on the volume fraction, which is actually surface cross-sectional density.
But is there then ever a dilute limit?
Dilute limit in the sense that the separation between rods goes to infinity? Yeah.
But it's always less than the length of the rods.
Yes.
It's rods are infinite, for sure.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That limit, I mean, if you had modeled it, collection of finite rods, again, it would be an anisotropic material, but the limit of dilute density, I think, is very different.
So
yesterday, Thorsten, you said that you are calculating interactions between cylinders.
Yeah, what we can do is, what we can do for cylinders is within our scattering approach. Uh-huh. Is so far for, it's slightly different limit, I think you are interested in here. So what we can do is infinitely long cylinders, but then we can look, say, at different ratio of radius to separation.
Mm-hmm.
And that, yeah. And that we can do for dielectric cylinders, but we have not included now a non-isotropic dielectric response. Mm-hmm. We just assume an isotropic dielectric function. And so in that limit, we could look at orientation dependence or just parallel cylinders in both retarded and non-retarded.
And non-retarded. Mm-hmm. So have you done that?
No, actually, we have all the pieces together. We just had to do the calculation. Mm-hmm.
This is all infinitely long.
The cylinder is infinitely long.
I think Melan's asking a harder question. You're asking this question.
Well, what I'm worried about is whether this limit can be taken at all. Because presumably what you are interested in is really ultimately interactions between nanotubes of long but finite length.
Mm-hmm.
And inherent in the way that you calculated is to take a dilute limit in which the length of the nanotubes is infinite.
Mm.
And I'm worried about it.
I think if you are looking at the finite angle,
yeah,
between them, then the fact that they are long or
exactly short
doesn't
matter.
Matter very
doesn't
much
matter.
As long as you are far away from the edge of the
mm-hmm.
from the ends of the nanotube. But if you are, that's another parameter that's related to what he discussed. If you are actually, you know, offset and
right,
you feel you're close to the edge, then it becomes important. And then I think you're right. This would not one has to think how to do that. But maybe. If you are looking at the generic case where you're far from where the distance between the nanotubes somehow is smaller than the distance to the end.
So at finite theta, maybe, but the theta equals to zero formula, would you believe that?
I believe it. I agree, it's tricky.
But the only reason it diverges is because it's infinite. So.
Right.
But one might think that because you're doing it, you know, you're dividing by the length and everything, these might be some sublimits or.
But you would maybe get away with talking per unit length, though, if they're just right, for the reason given.
I guess my feeling is that as long as you are dealing with infinite rods, just one medium,
mm-hmm.
they are infinite, there is no way that you can ignore the many body responses.
Mm.
And inherent to the calculation going to the dilute limit and getting two body responses is having ignored that at some point. Mm.
So for conductors, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
For dielectrics, it's not such a big deal.
So if you use the Rayleigh formula, the effective dielectric constant. That formula is only correct for order one in density, isn't it? It's not correct for order word squared.
Oh, here's an expansion that goes on and on.
Yeah, yeah.
You can go back and
you can take the whole, you know, expression, but it's not going to matter for the lowest order, for the second for the quadratic order in n. Doesn't matter. These are all higher order corrections. Yes, of course, there exists a whole, you know, series solution in the volume fraction or packing fraction, which is not linear in n. Yeah, but that doesn't matter for this case.
But going back to this question of spread, you said that these things stick together. Is it because of these interactions?
No, these are different interactions. So they stick together because, probably, because of hydrophobic interactions. And
in a solvent,
yes, in a solvent, absolutely, in water. So you cannot dissolve them in water. You just get a blob, a black blob. And the way people are approaching that, which is also interesting. So one idea was, and this is a person at DuPont that did that, is to take carbon nanotubes in solution with DNA, double-stranded DNA. You heat up the whole system. Carbon nanotubes are pretty stable, so nothing happens to them. But when you heat up DNA above 95 degrees, of course it dissociates into two strands. You get single-stranded DNA. Now single-stranded DNA, of course, sticks the bases out, the nitrogen bases, which look, I mean, they have a structure that's very similar to the graphene structure. And you can actually, I mean, you can calculate that. They like to glue onto it. So the single-stranded DNA that's floating in solution likes to adsorb onto the carbon nanotube. There are indications that it adsorbs in a helical manner. It's not clear exactly what the pitch of that helix is, whether it's connected with chemistry or electrostatics or who knows what, but it does adsorb with some structure. It's not just, you know, doesn't stick disorderly. There's some structure to it. Now, of course, by adsorbing with the bases, nitrogen bases, they bring with themselves the charges. And charges, of course, change the character of the surface of the carbon nanotube from hydrophobic to polar or charged. And it dissolves. And it turns out, if you do it properly with the correct DNA that doesn't self-associate back and so on, it stays in solution. So decorated carbon nanotube with either DNA adsorbed onto it or with, some people do it with lipids, more tricky. It would dissolve in aqueous solution and it remains there. And then because, of course, it's very long, it's charged and presumably the charge has a helical distribution on the carbon nanotube. It's possible that you will see some very nice mesophases in solution of a system like that. We know for DNA, you know, DNA is by itself, because it's double-stranded, has a helical motif of the charge, and it makes very complicated mesophases in solution. There's a whole slew of mesophases going from isotropic to the final crystalline phase that should be, in principle, seen with carbon nanotubes also. But there's a long way to go to do this kind of experiment. And the other thing is, maybe I should also mention this. So with DNA, you know, if you have DNA in solution and then you precipitate it by adding alcohol and salt. So if you add enough alcohol, that lowers the dielectric constant. The dielectric screening is bigger. And if you add enough salt, you also screen the charges on the DNA surface. And DNA would collapse. It makes a collapsed phase, which is liquid crystalline. And then if you put that in an alcohol solution, you can actually spin it like a thread, you know, like I don't know, silk thread. So DNA can be spun. This is called the wet spinning method for DNA. And you can spin it on a spinneret, and then you get a nice macroscopically oriented sample that you can cut and so on. And people have done exactly the same with carbon nanotubes with adsorbed single-stranded DNA. And why is that important? Because if you get a thread of carbon nanotubes, you know, carbon nanotubes have very interesting elastic properties. They have, you know, it's diamond basically. I mean, it's CC bond, so they're very stiff in one direction. And if you can make a thread out of that, you can use it to do something useful with it. So people are interested in that. And you use exactly the same technology as you use with DNA, because it's DNA-covered carbon nanotube. So the interactions are quite complicated. I think if somebody would be able to measure the interactions directly between two carbon nanotubes, then we could, you know, it would pay to have good theories of either van der Waals, electrostatic, and so on interactions. But we have to wait whether this is feasible or not.
Just talking with David Greer, just for interest. The problem is you can hold these rods in an optical trap. He can see quartz fibers and therefore try to make the measurements. But for some reason in his optical trap, he cannot see the carbon nanotubes. So the idea is somehow to make them visible, maybe working with a different frequency of light or something like this. Trouble is, if he does his measurement with the quartz fibers, we don't have the spectra against which to test. So it might give some information.
What's the size normally of the, to be called, what's the size of the carbon nanotubes?
Microns. More.
No, she means.
Oh, the radius?
Nanometer.
Nanometer. 10 angstroms. Very thin.
It was messy. I'm surprised because you talk to people who work with these things, and we started to do it in our lab, and it was very hard to get suspensions. And what you'll have sometimes is a mixture of the different nanotubes, so that you'll get finite-sized aggregates, which presumably has a very highly polar guy, and he has some less polar guys coating him. But then that's the end of it. You can't make a phase. You can't look at it with X-ray diffraction. You can't, because it just turns into these aggregates of oligonucleotide, whatever. So the heterogeneity is a huge problem. And if I understand from guys who make these things, they make a very nice chirality up to a point, then there's kind of a defect, and then it switches to a different pitch or something like that, out of one's control. And you don't know to what degree you need perfection in order to get good samples. But surely, when it can go from a dielectric to a semiconductor to a conductor, you're going to get huge differences in the interactions. And if you have one defect in a conductor, it'll totally change kinds of fluctuations that you're looking for. So there are huge practical problems still in the carbon nanotubes.
So I have just another question about this epsilon. So to what extent do you trust that there can you use K dependent epsilon?
Okay, K dependence, of course.
Nanotube, you will have to take that into account.
K dependence is tricky because there's K dependence also in water. You know, water is a structured medium. It's got epsilon of K and omega with its own length scale. And I'm not sure when you start fiddling with K dependence what exactly it is that you should be taking into account. There are calculations in the literature of the, maybe even this particular problem with K dependence, but I don't think they are really done properly.
Yeah, because I think that in the nanotubes you have all kinds of modes.
I agree. Totally agree. But so is water. I mean, we should not forget. If you start with epsilon of K for nanotubes, I think you have to do it for water also.
Well, but water is, at least in the, it depends in which phase of the nanotube you are, but for a metallic.
Metallic, okay.
For a metallic nanotube, then that. I would guess that would be important. And, in water, I think it's a sublating effect. So, well, I don't know. You know about this calculation.
We certainly didn't do epsilon of K. Mm-hmm. Not for water, not for nanotubes.
The model you have for epsilon of omega, do you know this for all ranges of omega, or what is important?
This is for the optical regime, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, you start with optical frequencies, and that's all we have. Yeah.
Well, the quantum calculation carries you a good long way.
That's true.
Quite a range, then.
So the other thing, which is maybe also interesting, the same kind of people are interested in. I mean, let's forget about calculating epsilon of omega. Let's try to find some case where you can measure it. not just measure epsilon of omega, but also measure the spatial profile of epsilon of omega. And it's not boxes. You know, the surfaces has a structure. And of course, if you have a small slab in between, a thin slab, you should take this structure into account. And there are cases like in intragranular films, if you have a strontium titanate at a certain range of temperatures, you can get a fluid layer in between two crystal grains. And the question is, what would be the van der Waals interactions in that case? And they, you know, this has important technological applications, because by changing the temperature in the way they do all sorts of technological things, you could vary the separation between two such crystal boundaries. And there, of course, you can measure by various spectroscopic techniques the profile of epsilon, the spatial profile, and for each point also the frequency dependence. It's a very complicated experiment, but it can be done. So the experimentalist could actually give you the whole profile in epsilon and R space of epsilon. And then you should use that in a kind of a Lipschitz theory to calculate the van der Waals interactions from there. And of course, you have to generalize it, because now you have a continuum dependence of epsilon on the spatial coordinate. There's no boxes anywhere. But it can be done. And there you can compare, of course, you can calculate the strength of the Lipschitz interaction directly from measured epsilon of omega. Here, we can't do that yet. You have to depend on one.
Another way, maybe, just thinking about the scattering approach, would be not to measure epsilon directly, but to measure the scattering phase shifts.
Uh-huh.
And that would, I mean, I think if you measure epsilon, you measure almost too much information you actually need for the interaction. What you need is just some kind of average over the volume of the object, which gives you the scattering phase shift.
Yeah.
And I think that's sufficient for the interaction.
But if you go to very small separations, would there be a problem?
There's a scale question here, isn't there?
Well, no, I mean, the scattering, if you know the scattering phase shift at all frequencies, they are frequency dependent. I think the frequency will tell you, or the distance you are interested in will tell you what frequency you have to measure the scattering properties.
The wavelengths, really.
Yeah, the wavelengths.
And you get some super high wavelengths that become relevant. Sorry, some small wavelengths become relevant in the cross distances.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm asking.
Yeah.
Life is real. It's tough. That's why you have to go back to the last form as a benchmark. But I agree completely.
Yeah.
We have friends who are beginning to measure spectra, see how much you can get.
Also, one thing that's connected with that is that, you know, for this geometry, people can measure torques, van der Waals torques, and that's been done by Capasso at Harvard recently. And there, of course, you need this kind of calculations with non-isotropic semi-infinite spaces in the retarded, non-retarded limit and so on. And there you can compare nicely with the experiment. What we don't have yet, let's say, is the same calculation for finite thickness boundaries. So in non-retarded case, it can, you know, it can do it very easily. But for retarded non-isotropic case, I have no clue how to do that, because even semi-infinite is totally complicated, and finite size slabs, I just have no clue how to approach this problem. So if somebody has a method that would work for that case, that's not, you know, that can be handled computationally and so on, that would be something.
Beginning of your story, you said that wrapping, besides wrapping, determines the dielectric properties. Now, all over the length of the nanotube, is the wrapping uniform, or are there defects so that wrapping?
You assume, of course, in the calculation, you assume it's
uniform,
but as Adrian pointed out, in the real life, you know, there are defects all over the place.
So that there are regions of, say, almost constant epsilon, and then drastic change in epsilon can occur along the length
yes.
of the nanotube. So
Yes.
Dealing with objects which have like domains of.
Could well be. Yeah, could well be. But that's not, you know, we have very little data on that.
Okay, thank you very much.